Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to episode number 50 of the Voice of Indie podcast. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and with me is my co-host, Stephen Jeeves. Congratulations on number 50. Stephen, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. Yeah, 50. Wow, we're nearing the one-year mark. Who would have ever thought we'd make it this long?
I tell you, it doesn't feel like it.
No. Been a hectic week, but now Lauren is back, so instead of spending hours trying to solve problems, I can spend hours giving her a list of problems for her to go work on. But we've got a great guest tonight. We've got some books out this week, and I'm taking off in a couple of days here for a few days. So next week's show, I should be in Chicago, probably in a hotel room when we do this thing, and I'm looking forward to that. But I'm going to go to Shedd Aquarium, which I haven't been to in a long time, Henry Ford Museum, and head down into Ohio, and Beam's going to be with me for that leg of the trip. Where are we going, Beam?
We're going to go to down in Toledo. First we're going to hit the Henry Ford Museum, which is really cool because I've never been there, even though it's right here in my state. And then down in Toledo, there's the Toledo Museum of Art, which is something I'm looking forward to. And then we're going to go over to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I've been to before, and Stephen, you've been there a few times. That's in Cleveland, and it's just an incredible place. We're both members. When I used to be in the band Led Zeppelin, just kidding. we're paid members. And it's important for those of you who enjoy music and the history of music to get involved in these kinds of things. You can become a paid member, and it's real cheap. It's like less than $50 a year, and you get in free anytime you go there with your card. And it's important to support this because this is how they keep these exhibits open. And I've been there before. I've seen Beatles memorabilia, the Rolling Stones, Metallica, Elvis. And it goes back to the old blues players from Robert Johnson from the 30s. I got some of his stuff on my iPod. I mean, it's just some really cool old stuff there. And they rely on these kind of memberships to bring the very best to you. So that's if you're interested in music and the history of music, check out Rock and Roll Hall of Fame about becoming a member. Steven.
So, if we have your name on our newsletter subscriber list, then you probably saw this morning's newsletter along with the announcement that Robert G. Willis Cross book Daedalus, which is the first of four novelettes in the Daedalus Files series, is now available in ebook form, free, no charge, no cost. And we're talking all the formats. You go to Amazon, you can get a free Kindle. You go to Barnes & Noble, you can get a free Nook. You go over to Rakuten, you can get a free Kobo. Wherever you get your ebooks, go look for Daedalus by Robert G. Willis Croft and download your free copy. Of course, the hope here is that you will enjoy it enough that you'll want to get books 2, 3, and 4 in the series, or go ahead and just get the omnibus, the Daedalus Files, which has all 4 stories in one volume. So that's Daedalus. And you can check out the trailer for Daedalus in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube. And we have a trailer for all 4 of the Daedalus books, also in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube.
Yeah, and also My 3 Wishes, which is a memoir by Kanoi Kay. This details her life with her family as traveling entertainers. This is available in all formats everywhere, so it's up and available. And get out there and check it out on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, whatever ebook format you're looking for, it's out there. So you can also get it in hardcover and softcover. So check it out. My Three Wishes.
Now the book Learning About Autism by Karen Ingalls is now out, and you can find the ebooks in several places, including the Kindle edition on Amazon. The print books are not popping up yet, but they should be in the next day or two. In fact, boxes for Karen Ingalls' event, boxes of books, have already been delivered down there to Florida. So it's kind of unusual that we can get author copies quicker than we can get books up on the retailers, but that seems to be the way things are running lately. I know I mentioned last time that I was kind of aggravated dealing with several of these companies, including the big one, Ingram, the big behemoth, Leviathan. Pick your superlative word for big monstrous thing, and that's what Ingram seems to be sometimes. But I finally managed to get to the person who's the supervisor over solving lots of problems there and got her information. So now we know who to bug when we have serious problems that we can't solve other ways. And she did send us a note saying that she rebroadcast Robert G. Willis Cross Operation Arctic Sting for us and cautioned us that when rebroadcasts happen, like the original broadcast, and this is when you put out all the metadata for a book to all of the retailers and to the distributors, she said that when that happens, beware. Sometimes the cover will disappear, it will come back, it will disappear. The blurbs will appear and then be gone. Sometimes the blurbs will be wrong. And basically, the gremlins get in there and like to mess things up for a few days before they tend to straighten themselves out automatically. But in the meantime, we usually jump up and down, get all worried about things not looking right. And eventually they are settling down. So those books are appearing now, and Learning About Autism, you can go order your ebook now, and hopefully you can order your print book sometime in the next day or two.
Yeah. All right. And I've been busy this week and last week indexing Hello Chattanooga, the latest book by author David Carroll, and that'll be publishing very soon. I'm about two-thirds of the way through it. As I mentioned last week, this is time-consuming. And it's tedious work because you have to you have to go line by line to it, and so it takes a lot of time. But I'm about two-thirds of the way through it, and I can tell you just by looking at it, going through it, this is going to be a cool book. If you're into music and entertainment and sports, it's got a little of everything in it. Mr. Carroll interviewed a lot of famous people throughout the years. But he also, in this book, he's given a history of the venue down there in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where these people played. And these go back to the early 19-teens. So you'll hear about, performers back then doing vaudeville on these stages. And it's just a really cool book. And he's got a lot of pictures to go along with it, too. But as I said, that'll be out very soon, publishing soon. So keep an eye out for that.
Now, we've been talking about the third Mac McDowell Mission series book by Robert G. Willis Cross called Operation Arctic Sting. Its release date is August 4th. It is in pre-sale right now, and it is populating out there. It's easy to find the ebooks in all the different formats. The print books have been appearing here and there. Oddly enough, Amazon seems to be the last place the print books are appearing. Usually, Amazon is the first. But we know it's in places like Barnes & Noble now. So if you've been waiting for that third Mac McDowell Mission series, if you want an ebook, go ahead and order it now. If you're looking for the print, check your favorite retailer, see if it's available yet. And if not, just kind of hang in there for another day or two. These things are certainly taking their time, but they are appearing. That's Operation Arctic Sting, a Mac McDowell Mission, third book in the series by Robert G. Willis Cross.
Trisha Guthrie's latest Legacy of Danger is now in the layout design stage, so that's getting closer to publishing. Cover art is in progress. I did the editing on this, and this is going to be a cool one because this book covers many different genres. There's some romance, some paranormal, some mystery thriller, murder mystery stuff in there, and it's going to be I think this is one of these that's going to find a wide audience. So keep an eye out for that one as well, Legacy of Danger by Patricia Guthrie.
And if you like poetry, we already have one poetry book out by Richard Jenkins called Behind the Smile, which is a collection of literary style poetry. We have kind of an everyman's poetry collection that we're working on right now by Joshua Stutzman. He's got about 240 poems in a book. The working title is Chaos, and we're going to have to pin that title down because we're starting to work on the cover. We've got cover art now, and the book is going to lay out this week, and we're hoping to have that out in a couple of weeks so that we can start banging our head against the wall wondering why it's not showing up in the retailers as quickly as we would like it to. But, you know, we do have fun with this. And that's Joshua Stutzman's working title, Chaos, a collection of poetry. We're looking forward to that one.
Cool. There Must Be Something in the Water by Abigail Hugeny is now in the layout stage as well. A look at a lot of locals in the Black community of South Carolina who have accomplished some remarkable things against the odds. She's collected many, many stories from just incredible people doing wonderful things. And like I said, against the odds. I mean, they're in a situation where you think, well, they're not going to succeed. And they do. So, again, keep an eye out for that. There Must Be Something in the Water.
Now, about a month ago, we had Carlisle Toms as a guest on the show. And Carlisle has a couple of books out, and he's not been happy with his publisher, so he decided to let Fresh Ink Group have the privilege and honor of republishing new editions of his books with new covers and some new looks about them. And the first one is going to be The Calling Dream. Right now, it's in layout. In fact, it's almost ready to go for the book interior, and we're having a new cover digitally painted by our staff artist, Anik. And that, in fact, I need to send him the second draft of that artwork tonight because that's getting pretty close to being done, too. So hopefully, we'll be able to start talking about that book seriously in a couple of weeks as well.
Yeah, we're very busy at Fresh Ink Group. We have more than a dozen more books in progress, including Andrew McGregor's How to Paint an American. That's now in the editing stage. So we've got all kinds of cool stuff coming your way. If you're a reader, Fresh Ink Group is the place to be. If you're a writer, Fresh Ink Group is the place to be.
So, people, we'd like to see some interaction today, some phone calls, some tweets, some smoke signals, something. And we've got a little roll-in telling you how.
Call 516-453-9902 right now with your questions or comments for tonight's guest. Or post a note on Twitter with hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of the tweet, and we'll read it on air. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group on Twitter.
Call now and you can be a winner.
Now, we already have a tweet from Dr. Helen Burrell. Dr. Helen was listening to the show last week like she does every week. She says she looks forward to it, and we like to hear people say things like that. But when she was trying to tweet some support for Dr. Williscroft, because she has become a fan of his, she was using the at Fresh Ink Group rather than the hashtag Fresh Ink Group, so we weren't seeing them and reading them. And she was not quite understanding what was going on there, but we know she's with us tonight, and she's already got a tweet up here. She says, Mr. Mayor, you have me all spaced out. Sure you aren't triplets waiting all those writing all those awe-inspiring volumes? How can merely one writer give birth to so many fresh ideas so often? Sir, you swept me up in your website, alistairmayer.org. I'm caught in your space-time continuum. That's from Dr. Helen Burrell. Glad to have you with us this week, Helen, but so that we can hear you and see what you're saying this time.
Yeah. Hashtag Fresh Ink Group. Remember that.
Yeah. Now, that brings us to today's guest, which is famed science fiction writer Alistair Mayer. And here's his bio. Now, if you get the newsletter, you've got a different version of his bio on there, so I'm using the one that he's got on Amazon just so we can kind of, between the two of them, get a little bit more contrast. Alistair Mayer was born in London, and his science fiction roots trace back through his father, Douglas Mayer, who also published some of Arthur C. Clarke's first works, to the world's first science fiction convention in Leeds in 1937. Now, just as an aside, if you're not, you know, a serious science fiction fan, you might not know Arthur C. Clarke. He's known for a lot of stories, right? Childhood Zen, Rendezvous with Brahma, things like that, but most lay people associate him with like 2001 A Space Odyssey, which was made into a phenomenal movie by Stanley Kubrick. But back to the bio. Mayer is an experienced scuba diver and pilot who studied astrophysics, biology, and computer science at Queen's University at Kingston, Canada, much of which influences his writing. He has been published in Byte magazine and at conferences on space exploration and development, as well as multiple times in Analog Science Fiction magazine. Boy, that one goes back. I used to read that even back to high school. As a child, he moved with his family to Canada and now lives in Colorado, making trips back to the UK when he can, such as the Brighton Worldcon and the upcoming Worldcon in London. He apologizes for the occasional lapse into American spelling in his writing. And apparently that was it. I thought there was another paragraph. So welcome to the show, Alistair. Glad to have you.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here. And I have to thank Dr. Helen Burrell for her kind comments, too. That was very nice.
Yeah.
So now you were born in the UK, lived in Canada. You're living in Colorado. Whereabouts in Colorado are you living?
I'm in Centennial, which is a suburb nestled up next to Denver. I mean, it's basically just greater Denver.
So that's over there near last week's guest, Robert G. Willescroft, correct?
That's right. I know Robert pretty well, and we live about a mile away from each other, so I see him fairly often.
Small
we
world.
Get together typically. Excuse me.
So if you grew up with a father who published people like Arthur C. Clarke, I'm assuming that you were interested in reading and maybe even writing from a very young age. Would that be true?
That's very true. Although, interestingly enough, I wasn't aware of my dad's connection with science fiction until I was in my late teens, mid to late teens when I discovered it. He never really talked about that part of his life very much, but he did definitely influence me. I remember that some of the first movie I remember going to see with the family was something about the Three Stooges go to the moon.
I remember that one.
Yeah. And he also provided me, if you remember, the classic illustrated comic book versions of classic works. So there were comic books, but they were versions of things like Jules Verne's stories, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Mysterious Island,
yeah.
H.G. Wells, Robert Louis Stevenson, all those. So while I was reading Superman comics, he was also slipping me, classic science fiction.
Cool. And we do have a couple more comments on Twitter.
Okay.
All right.
Jill Mayer says, Gremlins from Alistair Mayer's story, Gremlin Gambit, must be infiltrating your systems. Yeah, I haven't read Gremlin Gambit yet, but I certainly have to agree with that. And Robert Willescroft added the note that Arthur C. Clarke also invented the space satellite. That's true. He wrote about a lot of things that turned out to be quite prescient about future technology.
He did.
That's interesting.
Yeah, my father's connection with him was back before the Second World War. He was, this would have been in the 30s, so my dad would have been in his teens and early 20s. And he and Arthur C. Clarke and in fact, several other science fiction writers, Eric Frank Russell is another one, were all part of the fledgling British science fiction community. And my dad published what is called a fanzine. And for those who aren't, part of the community, the fanzine is just, back in those days, it was typically a mimeographed magazine put out, purely volunteer basis by somebody, using letters and retyped and sent out multiple copies. But he's included in three different issues of The magazine was called Amateur Science Stories, and Arthur Clarke submitted three different stories to that, which my dad published. This would have been about 1937, 38.
Wow. Now, going back to your childhood, Stephen had asked about, you know, where you were a reader and whatnot. Did you start writing back then, your own story? Or did it just come later?
Yes and no. I have a memory from, like, I think it was third grade of writing. I don't remember what the exact assignment was, but it was, you know, write a story. I wrote a one-page story about an astronaut visiting the pink with purple spots universe and being chased by a creature with 100 arms and legs, and the creature managed to trip over its own legs so the astronaut could escape.
And you didn't publish that?
No, and unfortunately I don't know, you know, if that's amongst my papers that, you know, my mother kept or whatever happened to it, but that's the earliest one I remember. And then, I don't think I wrote any more science fiction until I was in high school creative writing class.
Now, what about those stories in high school? Do you still have any of those?
I may have one, which actually the teacher rather liked. It was, he told us, the first week of the class in creative writing, that, you know, we basically had to write a story every couple of weeks, and they would be, you know, each one would be copied and passed around to everybody in the class for critique. So it was very much like a writer's group, which was a great experience. And he said, you know, don't write how I spent my summer vacation. So, of course, you know, I wrote how I spent my summer vacation. And the beginning of that, this was a senior year of high school, so it would have been the summer before senior year. Buddies and I, we rode our bicycles out about 50 miles to where his parents had a campsite. There was no cottage there yet, and we just camped out in a tent. And across the other side of the lake, there was a girls' camp. So the story was titled The Great Girls' Camp Raid. Yeah, spoiler alert, it turned out there were no girls there because it was still too early in the season. but we had a number of incidents, and he enjoyed the story. He said I should try publishing it, but I never did. There are a couple others I vaguely remember, but I'm not sure if I have copies of them.
Now, over on Twitter, we've got a comment from Verwayne. He says he remembers fanzines. He loved those as a kid. He says, I also remember Penny Dreadfuls, but I never met Edgar Allan Poe.
I met him once. He was drunk.
So, Beam, I think we should get into our first commercial here and remind listeners that you can call in at 516-453-9902, talk to Alistair, ask a question, make a comment, try to sell us something, whatever you're interested in. Or get over to Twitter and put hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of your tweet so that we can read your comment or question on air. Now, this first commercial that we're going to play, we've been talking about the book, Learning About Autism by Karen Ingalls, and we just got through making the commercial literally minutes before this podcast, so it won't even be up on YouTube until later tonight or tomorrow sometime, but the audio part of it we've got ready to play right here, right now, and this is the world premiere of the radio commercial for Learning About Autism.
Dun, da, da.
Learning About Autism, one mother's journey of discovery and love, a charter school, teaching methods, and resources is the book millions of families must have. Carol Tucker travels the road of autism and cerebral palsy with her adopted son, Justin, now a young man who routinely astounds physicians with his achievements. She is a special education teacher, recognized leader in children's advocacy, and one of the founders of Florida's first charter school for autism, where she served as director. Through photos and stories, best-selling author Karen Ingalls shares Carol's journey, then offers a wealth of resources, teaching methods, school choices,
and financial assistance options. With Karen's unique insight, learning about autism shows how one very determined mother and her family can rise above daunting challenges to thrive and find happiness. Learning About Autism is published worldwide in jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all ebook editions.
All right.
Goosebumps. I got goosebumps just listening to it. So, again, watch the video to be up on YouTube pretty soon, and we'll make sure our social media manipulator, Sam, puts it in next week's newsletter, too, which, if you don't subscribe, go to freshinkgroup.com, scroll down to the bottom of the home page, and fill out that little form so you can get your very own newsletter every week, too.
Yeah. We do have another comment on Twitter, Robert G. Willis-Croft. Oh, never mind. He said not for broadcast. I should have read that part first. All right.
Top secret.
Yeah. So education, Alistair. Stephen touched on some of the stuff that you studied and in the bio. Would you care to elaborate on that, where you went to school, what did you major in?
I can. Yeah, I went to Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, which coincidentally is the same university that Elon Musk of SpaceX went to for a few years, although he was there. He was there much later than I was. I preceded him by, 15 or 20 years or so. 15 years. Anyway,
take the long number.
Maybe it was 10. I majored in life sciences and computer science. I was originally thinking of going into biomedical engineering. And after, after second year, I realized I was, I was acing computer science. And while I wasn't doing bad in the life sciences, the biological sciences, they were a lot more work for me. It was always memorization of especially anatomy class. The naming of things in human anatomy is totally bizarre. It's either based on where it is or what it looks like or who discovered it. And, they had no particular rhyme or reason. So after that, I switched almost entirely to computer science and ended up spending most of my career as either a software engineer and what has come to be called DevOps, where you're part computer operator and part software developer. And that, that set me in pretty good stead. In fact, it was through that. I always had a great interest in space, too, but originally as a kid and a teenager, I wanted to be an astronaut, like many kids. But that hope was kind of dashed when I went for my medical. I joined the Army Reserves Signal Corps, and looking at the eye chart and realizing, well, crap, I can't read the bottom line on the eye chart. In fact, I can't even read the third from the bottom. And that was when I realized I needed to wear glasses. And at the time, if you wore glasses, you were not going to become an astronaut or even a jet pilot. So I kind of put that on hold, and that's why I went into, the biology and computer science. As far as the computer software development goes, I mentioned or Stephen mentioned my bio that I wrote for Byte Magazine. That connection was through some software I was working on. This would have been in the early to mid 1980s, before the internet as we know it, and way before the World Wide Web. But Byte, being a personal computer, one of the big computer publications for computer hobbyists and professionals, was setting up a conferencing system, basically the forerunner of something like Facebook, no pictures, just text. And I was developing software at University of Guelph for just that, Byte looked at the system that I developed, and they liked it, and they said, you know, hey, we want to use this for our Byte information exchange. Which they did. I ended up consulting with them to set up the software and also writing a few articles for them. But through that, because Jerry Purnell, who many of you all know is a science fiction writer, also wrote a regular column for Byte magazine and was obviously they wanted to get him on board with the information exchange system. I struck up an email conversation with Jerry because I'd read a lot of his stuff. And Byte magazine ended up sending me down to Jerry's house, which he called Chaos Manor in L.A., actually North Hollywood, but to walk him through the system. And because we both have an interest in space and science fiction, it took him about 5 minutes to learn how to use the software. He's not a dumb guy, or was, rather. We spent the afternoon and into the evening talking space and science fiction, and became good friends. And through him, I met a number of other science fiction authors, including Larry Niven, who's one of my favorites. I think it was probably through knowing, you know, real authors who had been my idols, and certainly still are. I still love their work. I thought I'd try my hand at it and got serious about sending stories in to get published. Boy, that's a long way from Queen's University, but...
But it fills in all the gaps.
Yeah, when you mentioned that you were interested in becoming an astronaut, I hadn't really thought of Canada having much of a space program, but
in fact, it did. It obviously, in cooperation with NASA, they built the arm for both the shuttle uses and the space station uses, called the Canadarm. But as part of that cooperation, Canada was invited to send astronauts up on the space shuttle. So they opened up there's a Canadian Space Agency. They opened up a Canadian astronaut program and sent out, this again would have been early to mid 1980s, they sent out a call for people who were interested in becoming astronauts. So I thought, what the heck? And I sent in my application along with about 4,000 other people. As it turned out, they, after narrowing down through the selections, they narrowed it down to about 100 people. I don't know the exact number. And they sent me a letter that said, you know, dear astronaut candidate, you made it this far. If you want to go further, here's the next round of questions and essays and so on, which of course I replied to, but that's about as far as I got. And when I saw who actually made the cut, they selected six out of that original 4,000. And they were all people with, you know, two doctorates or thousands of hours of time in fighter jets. And that, well, you know, I don't feel bad having lost out to these guys.
What sort of hobbies do you have when you're not writing science fiction? How do you spend your
reading.
Time?
Do you still go diving?
I haven't gone diving in quite a while. I kind of gave that up about the time I moved to Colorado. There aren't a lot of places to dive in Colorado. There are a few.
That's what airplanes are for.
Well, this is true. And actually, come to think of it, I started flying after I started tapering off my diving. So that was where my money went, on flying lessons. It was my I met my first wife on a dive trip, and it was, she and I were really into diving. And then when I split up with her and moved, I was more into the flying. And then I got into spending my money going to science fiction conventions and space conventions. And space conventions were space conference rather is actually where I met my second wife. So. So I have dived. I come to think of it, my daughter took her senior year of high school offered scuba diving lessons. So when she finished her certification, I made a point of recertifying so that, you know, should the opportunity arise, I could go diving with her. Opportunity never did arise. She ended up doing some volunteer diving in the aquarium here in Denver before she moved. But I guess that was the last time I went diving. It was in a pool to requalify.
Did you still do any parachuting?
I haven't done that since since college. I only did a few jumps. And actually I was before I had a car, because I remember bumming a ride with my parents one time and with you know, friends another time to get to the airfield where we jumped. And it was a lot of sitting around waiting for the plane, because there were, you know, a number of, we only had one plane. It was a little four-seat Cessna 172 and a lot of people who wanted to jump out of it. So I only got a few jumps in, and it just kind of became more trouble than I thought it was worth at the time. I had a lot of fun doing it. I'd probably do it again if I, you know, weren't worried about and my knees at my age. But jumped out of a plane a few times.
Yeah, jumping out is easy, but the landings get a little bit tougher the older you get, it seems.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, the technology has improved a lot too. It's I was jumping on the old round chutes, and the newer parasails are apparently a lot more comfortable. But there you go.
And you're president of a society?
I'm sorry, say again?
Are you president of a society?
Not anymore. I was actually the National Space Society, or which... before that, there was another society called the L5 Society, which promoted building colonies in space, and it merged with National Space Society. I was president of two different chapters, a chapter in Waterloo, Ontario, and the chapter here in Denver after I moved to Colorado. And we had a lot of fun. We did, you know, bring in guest speakers to talk about space-related topics. We put on, displays and presentations, shopping balls and the like for Space Day, and participated in space conferences, giving papers, things like that. I still do that from time to time. I do more of that kind of thing at science fiction conventions these days. I'll give presentations both on fictional topics and on hard science topics for people who are interested. And those are usually pretty well attended. I like to talk about what's cutting edge on space technology and related topics. And you can imagine at a science fiction convention, that kind of thing gets a good turnout.
Now, you do a lot of travel when you go to these conventions, don't you?
It can be. Now, Mile Icon, which you mentioned in the bio, is local here in Denver. It's every October, and I'll be there at the next one. There are also the World Science Fiction Convention is held at a different location around the world, usually in North America, but every couple of years or so they try to get it outside North America. It's been everywhere from, you know, Iceland to New Zealand to Britain, obviously. This year in December, it's in Washington, D.C. And there are bigger regional conventions. The WesterCon is another one, which is always held somewhere west of the Mississippi. It has been held in Texas, California, Utah. So some of these move around. Some of these are always in the same place. They're like Comic-Cons, only way smaller. A typical Comic-Con will have it can have over 100,000 people, which is mind-bogglingly huge, whereas a typical WorldCon is more like about 3,000 people. Just big enough to have a lot of fun and without waiting and spending all your time waiting in lines.
Yeah, Comic-Cons, they get like, you know, the TV shows and the movies and all that. So they got, you know, the actors and, you know, people like that show up. So I'm guessing that's probably a real big draw for them. That's why they see 100,000 people.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And the other ones, they're called literary science fiction conventions. And literary is maybe a bit pretentious. It just means it focuses more on the written word than on film or TV. Although,
yeah.
Usually there'll be a movie room where people can watch movies, and there'll be some comic related panels. But the guests tend to be writers rather than actors.
Now, Alistair, if you hear of any events that are coming to Northeast Alabama, you got a place to stay. I'm only a half hour from Huntsville, which is the center of the aerospace industry in the United States, and it's
true.
Arsenal is. Where Wernher von Braun did all of his work. In fact, half the stuff around Huntsville is named for Wernher von Braun, like the von Braun Center and whatnot. And it's where the space camp is. You hear about kids going to space camp. That's right here in Huntsville. And the Davidson Museum, it's got an outdoor museum that's got like full-size Saturn rockets and a lot of the original rockets, capsules, and various things from the space program over the years, too. So this is a very space-interested town out here where I am, and there's a lot to see and do. All you people out there who are interested in space, Northeast Alabama and the Huntsville area is a great place to visit. And like I said, Alistair, if you hear some events, because they got events all the time over there at the Arsenal and at the Space Museum, let me know if you've got a place to stay.
I'll certainly do that, and I can certainly second your recommendation. My second wife and I spent a week at adult space camp down there, and we had a great time. It was awesome. I loved it. You know, I wouldn't mind doing it again. And then as a side trip, we went up to Lynchburg to visit the Jack Daniels distillery.
Oh,
that's the only reason to go to Lynchburg.
If you spend enough time in Lynchburg, you'll be in space.
Yeah, I think we even was at Space Gate. Yeah, we did a dive in one of the training tanks at one of the NASA facilities there. That was great fun. Absolutely. Recommend that to anybody who's interested in space and can get to that area.
Yeah, and one of the fun things about living in this area is, you know, there's mountains all around. So half the time when you're driving somewhere, you're up on a high elevation, and for a lot of miles, you can look across these valleys and see all of those rockets that are all around that space center. Like, for example, the Apollo 11, they've got the entire thing, the way it stood on the launch pad from top to bottom. And then not too far away from it, they have a space shuttle on the booster rockets right there outside where you can see them. There's a stealth bomber and some others, too. And there are just so many places all around this area where if you're up high enough and look in the right direction, it's like, wow, look at all the rockets on the horizon. And I just love seeing that. That's just a lot of fun.
No, that's great. Yeah. The only thing I know of that off the top of my head in that area, which is, without looking at a map, I couldn't tell you how close, but it's in Atlanta, and that's the Dragon Con every year. It's in the fall. That's a fairly big convention.
Now, Beam, you want to look at Twitter? You got some comments over there.
All right, let me hit the refresh here.
I'll start then. Robert Willis Cross says hip bone connected to the thigh bone, the thigh bone connected to the leg bone.
Okay.
And you want to tell them about Verwaine's post?
Yeah, Verwaine has posted. He said, hi, a bit of a personal post here. Thought y'all might want to see the we I always refer to. Now, Verwaine and his wife, Lisa, they are loyal listeners. They're here every week faithfully. They comment, call in from time to time. He says, we are rapidly approaching our first anniversary, which is August 1st. Congratulations. And things couldn't be better. You can listen to their story in Finding Myself Again. It's an Audible audiobook, and you can go to Amazon and find it there. Finding Myself Again by Verwaine Greenhoe. And he posted a nice picture of himself and his wife. And again,
very
congratulations.
Nice,
coming up on 1 year. I'm thrilled to have you guys in the audience. I'm even more thrilled to consider you two friends. So thank you for listening to us each week.
And Karen Ingalls posted, she says, I made a pact with my grandson that I would skydive on my 90th birthday. Am I crazy?
Yeah.
Now I have 10 years to think about it. No, that's not crazy at all. Yeah. On a more serious note, your books sound interesting, Alistair. I will check out the Delta Pavanis Discovery when it is available. Hashtag
I will say this. I will say this about skydiving. I see absolutely no reason, unless the plane's going down, to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. So
it's a lot of fun.
That's my view on it.
I've only done that probably 7 or 8 times in my life. And when I was thinking about that this past week, it occurred to me, every time I've ever gone skydiving, it's because I was going out with a woman who wanted to try it.
Yeah, there's not a woman alive that's going to convince me to jump out of an airplane.
That's not the only crazy thing that women have talked me into doing over the years, but it always turned out to be fun, you know, especially if you just want to do a day trip. You go to these places that offer the skydiving. They'll usually give you like a 2 or 3 hour lesson and hang you in the harness and help you practice how to land and do some basic stuff. But then, you know, it's a static line jump for a while until you're fully certified, meaning that you don't have to worry about pulling a ripcord. You just get out there, get yourself into position, and then just push off and kind of tumble back. The static line will open your chute for you. And most of these places will put a walkie-talkie in your pack so that they can talk to you. They're watching you with binoculars, and if they see you up there looking like you're freaking out, they, you know, they might say, hey, pay attention. You know, you got to turn right and head towards your to the drop zone or whatever. So it's not that hard to do. In fact, once you get out of the plane, it gets real easy for a little while until you notice that ground that was so far away is coming at you really fast. And you got to start thinking about, you know, sticking that landing and so that you kind of roll and distribute your weight. But it's easy. It's fun. It's inexpensive. And, you know, Karen, I would love to see the pictures. You know, was it George Herbert Walker Bush did that when he was, I think, 90? Yeah, I believe it was 90,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
His 90th birthday, yeah.
Yeah, so there is precedent for it. And no, trying something new when you're 90, that's not that crazy at all. So, Beam, you want to play another commercial?
Sure.
All right, let's talk about Phil Lippert's book. Phil Lippert's book is our bestseller this week, and I mean by a fairly wide margin. His book is going gangbusters out there. So let's hear about crimes and the people who commit them.
Gangbusters? Do the kids still say that?
Yeah, they do.
Phil Lippert was thrown into the bowels of the Michigan Department of Corrections as a 17-year-old adolescent. He remained entrenched in a world of malfeasance for the next 40 years. With astonishing honesty, he reveals the raw details of what a life of incarceration looks like from the inside. His observations of human behavior and his stellar ability to tell a story reveal the courage and resilience of a man who has survived horrifying and savage injustice. Sometimes tragic, but often humorous and redemptive, Crimes and the People Who Commit Them offers a poignant collection of stories and miscreants and corrupt institutions, tales of men who have made poor choices and suffered grave consequences. Through it all, Phil Lippert displays a sly sense of humor and the quiet wisdom of a man who is, ultimately, a survivor. Lippert's journey has been one of an unrequited longing for freedom. Crimes and the People Who Commit Them is proudly published in jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats, available worldwide.
I have read that book, and I highly recommend it. I gave it a 5-star review, and it earned all 5 of those stars. So get out there and grab a copy of that. Now,
a listener.
Go ahead. No, I was just
going to say.
Go ahead.
Listeners, if you want to head over and start looking for Alistair's books, you'll find that there's a couple of anthologies. One's called Alistair Mayer, A Sample, and then that is a half a dozen of his stories. And there's one called Footprints, where he's one of the co-editors, and has Alistair, it was your first story, is the one that's in Footprints?
That's right. That was my first story I sold, was to that anthology. The theme of the anthology is, you know, some arbitrary point in the future when humans aren't around anymore, aliens land on the moon and find, you know, the remains of the Apollo missions and our astronauts' footprints and so on, which will, of course, last for millions and millions of years. And what do these aliens make of what they find? And I took that as a starting point and flashed back and forth between what the aliens are finding and the actual Apollo missions. I studied the transcripts from the various Apollo moonwalks and incorporated some incidents into that. And that was the first sale.
That's a great introduction to your work. I want to note on Twitter, too, that after that commercial Verwaine posted, I worked in that prison, and I know that Mr. Lippert is spot on with his story, Crimes and the People Who Commit Them. So there's an endorsement from somebody who had some experience on the inside, luckily collecting a paycheck for being there. But, yeah.
yeah, everybody's not so fortunate enough to collect a paycheck being there. Now, you're just talking about this short story that you had written. You're known as a science fiction author. Have you written outside of that genre?
Not a lot. Excuse me. Not a lot. Everything I write seems to turn back into science fiction. I wrote what started out as a fantasy story, urban fantasy, I guess, with fairies and gremlins, and that became Gremlin Gambit, which was mentioned earlier. That the science fiction in that is, you know, if Earth is being invaded by aliens or attacked by aliens, and if the fairy folk are real, would they want to help defend Earth against aliens? And I decided they would, and wrote kind of a tongue-in-cheek story about this guy, the Air Force officer, who's working at Area 51 on the defense against aliens, and this fairy shows up in his office and says, you know, we want to help. And that became the Gremlin Gambit. I had a hard time selling that because, you know, the hard science fiction magazines weren't interested, and the straight fantasy magazines weren't interested, but I finally did manage to place it. So.
Yeah, and now they call them crossovers, and that's the rage, these combining genres these days. But you have an homage to Edgar Allan Poe, true?
That's true. I was invited to submit a story to an anthology called Space Horrors. You have to be careful how you pronounce that. horror stories set in space. And so I wrote one called Poetic Justice, which is an homage to Edgar Allan Poe, based off of his A Cask of Amontillado, wherein a sleeper ship. A sleeper ship is a starship which takes many years to travel between stars, and so the most of the crew and passengers are in suspended animation with just one person at a time on a 6-month rotation is awake to, you know, monitor the system. I think there's a movie a couple of years back called Traveler, which used the same idea. And the idea is one of the main character wakes up, the Montresor character wakes up and by his shift predecessor and somehow becomes convinced that that the predecessor has awoken Montresor's wife from suspended animation earlier, and they were having an affair before going back into hibernation, and so he decides to take his revenge against the character that is about to go back into hibernation.
Now, you have a series called the Alpha Centauri series, and I'm finding three volumes for that, First Landing, Sawyer's World, and The Return?
Yes, that's a trilogy. That is set in all of my novels, in fact, are set in what I call T-Space. It stands for terraformed space, which is basically a bubble of stars about 50 light years across and has dozens of terraformed planets around, you know, the various sun-like stars. The thing is, we find that they've all been terraformed millions of years ago with life that was exported from Earth millions of years ago. Nobody's quite sure who or why or how, but as far as humans are concerned, this is great. We have easy places to colonize around other stars. And the whole series starts with the Alpha Centauri series, when we first get out there to Alpha Centauri and realize that, hey, these Earth-like planets aren't just Earth-like. They were, you know, basically cross-fertilized with life from Earth. And the trilogy follows. The first landing is, as the title suggests, it's the first landing, and they explore the first of the two planets there. They have some incidents. Basically, things are going wrong right from the start. It's supposed to be a six-ship expedition, and one of them turns out to have technical difficulty, so they're already down to five ships. The lead exobiologist on the mission has an accident in training, so they have to replace him. And it turns out that the replacement, he's a perfectly qualified exobiologist, but he's also the ex of the second in command of the mission, and so there's a bit of tension and conflict there. It kind of goes, parts of it go downhill from there, but they also discover that these planets are terraformed. Now, the second one, Sawyer's World, Elizabeth Sawyer is the second in command. And after discovering that the first planet is terraformed, they figure they should check out the second planet as well. Problem is, because this is early in our interstellar travel, we don't have the technique for getting the ship back off the planet requires technology that they lost one of on the mission. So they could land on the planet, or they could send one ship down to the planet, but it couldn't get off again. And they figure it's important enough to do that. So Elizabeth Sawyer takes the ship down and, expecting to be recovered by the USS Heinlein. The two of the ships are the Paul Anderson and the Robert Heinlein. I figured the American ships would be named after science fiction writers.
Definitely. As they should.
Anyway, they figure that, you know, okay, they'll go down to the planet while the Heinlein and the other ships go back to Earth, get the refueling module, and come back. Come back in a few weeks. The weeks turn into months, and the months turn into years, and Sawyer is faced with keeping her team alive on this planet, which, while it's terraformed, it's still a wild planet. So I drew inspiration from Jules Verne's Mysterious Island and Heinlein's Tunnel in the Sky for that, and a lot of, what do you do when you're stranded on a planet kind of thing.
Do you expect another volume? volume after the return, or is this a trilogy?
Yes and no. As far as the return, obviously tells a story of you know why it took them so long to get the return mission, and finally the return to pick them up. That's the end of the Alpha Centauri trilogy per se. The story continues in a different series, both Kakaloa, which is the name they give to the first planet they land on in the Alpha Centauri system. One of the reasons they go back, I mean, aside to rescue the first crew, is that they discover in samples they brought back an anti-aging drug in something that they berries in a tree that were being eaten by a tree-climbing octopus called tree squids. So squid berries, as they've come to be known, turn into a thriving crop on the planet Kakaloa, except that the berry farmers are having a problem with tree squids eating their crop. So So the book Kakaloa, A Rising Tide is not part of the Alpha Centauri series per se, because it's a new story arc with mostly different characters, but it follows the story of a marine biologist, Ellie Greystone, trying to figure out how to get the dank tree squids to stop eating the berries. There's also a couple of secondary story arcs. There's a character named Perry Cohen, who is a real estate resort developer on Earth, and he takes a look at the pictures of Kakaloa, and it's got gorgeous Hawaii-like beaches, and figures, hey, you know, with the cost of interstellar travel coming down, which is, you know, part of the return, maybe we could set up a resort hotel on Kakaloa. So that's what he's doing. He's trying to set up a resort on Kakaloa that, of course, being outside Earth's jurisdiction has casinos and whatever else.
Okay, so book one is A Rising Tide. And then the second book, The Downhill Slide, you're still working on that?
The second one I'm still working on. I've got about 50,000 words, so I hope to have it done by the end of the year, hopefully in time for Christmas. That's A Downhill Slide. That takes place a couple of years after Rising Tide, and you know, things are going pretty well with the economy. There's mining, there's squidberry farming, there's casinos and holiday resorts, and then things start to go wrong. There's a murder in the casino, actually in the hotel, and that's one of the things I started to do with this book is the main character is a detective who has from Earth, you know, originally from Scotland Yard, who has emigrated to the Alpha Centauri system, and he's called in to investigate this basically a locked room murder mystery. They find the body on one of the elevators, and the elevator cameras show nothing. You know, they have to try and figure out what's going on. And then, of course, there are secondary stories with problems with the mines. There's some illegitimate activity going on elsewhere on the planet that's unauthorized by the UZ government and so on, the Earth government and so on. So that's why things are starting to go downhill. And then there'll be another volume after that called Crash and Burn, which is basically the low point of the Kakaloa economy, which is a reference I make in another book, two-line reference, which kind of spawned this whole series, where a guy is complaining about, you know, thriving squidberry industry in Alpha Centauri that, you know, collapses after a couple of years when the drug companies figure out how to synthesize the stuff. So I figure, okay, well, let's write that. And so Crash and Burn is when the economy crashes and then the tide turns. It's the tentative title for the fourth volume, and that'll bring things back to where the next series, which is the Carson and Robert series, takes off.
All right.
You got a lot on your plate there.
and we're going to talk about the Carson and Robert's T-Space series next. We're going to slide one more commercial in here.
We do have a caller. Yeah.
Okay.
You want to take the call first or take the commercial?
Well, let's knock the commercial out because the call will be about T-Space series probably.
Okay.
This is the High Road, Mark Herndon, and he and his wife Leah are going to be our guests in 2 weeks. So if you're interested, pay attention.
What drives a man to spend 26 years performing night after night? To persevere through a stifling tour bus, bad food, strange women, flared tempers, a plane nearly blown from the sky. Just how did that troubled military brat with a dream claw his way from dirt floor dive bar shows to the world's biggest stages? Aviator, author, and country music Hall of Fame drummer Mark Herndon lived that dream playing with Alabama, one of the most popular and celebrated bands of all time. He learned some hard lessons about people and life, the music industry, the accolades and awards, how easy it is to lose it all, and how hard it is to survive, to embrace sobriety, to live even one more day. Herndon's poignant memoir offers a tale at once cautionary and inspirational, delightful and heartbreaking, funny yet deeply personal. From innocence to rebellion to acceptance, can a man still flourish when the spotlight dims? Are true forgiveness, redemption and serenity even possible when the powerful say everything you achieved somehow doesn't even count? That you're not who you and everyone who matters thought you were? Find all this and more in Mark's remarkable memoir, The High Road, Memories from a Long Trip. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group in paperback and ebooks, and now in the keepsake dust-jacketed hardcover edition demanded by true fans. Mark Herndon refuses to slow down. So look back, look ahead, and join him on the trip. He's taking the high road.
All right. And like Steven said, they're going to be on the show in 2 weeks. So be sure to tune in. Now we have two callers here. So we're going to take the first one that came in. This is going to be area code 818. Hello, caller. You are on the air. Welcome to the show. What is your name and where are you calling from?
This is Robert Williscroft.
Hello, Robert Williscroft. Welcome to the show.
My number looks like I'm calling from North Hollywood, but actually I'm calling from Denver.
All right.
So you got a question, comment, or just want to join the chat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Alistair, nice to talk with you.
And you.
You've been talking on and off throughout this call about your books. You mentioned the Alpha Centauri series, and you mentioned the Carson and Roberts here at the end, and you kind of hinted at, but didn't say much about, the fact that all of your stories in these overlapping and intertwining series have a huge grand mystery behind them, and that is the T-Space, the terraformed planets that keep showing up, and yet you haven't told anybody at all who the heck did that, and is that ever going to be revealed? Is it just something you might even reveal on the air here?
Well, I'm not going to reveal it here, but I do. There will be more hints about it coming up. Yeah, tell you the truth, when I wrote the first book, the first one I wrote was The Caro Talisman, which we haven't talked about yet. I wrote that 10 years ago. And I had a couple of ideas about where I would go with who did it. And I actually talked him over with my son Robert, and the first idea he didn't like at all. It involved time travel, and when he reacted to it, I kind of thought about it and said, you know, you're right, that's a stupid idea. And so that's off the table. I have a totally different solution to this, and in fact, I think it's a better one. And I've started throwing hints of that into the later books as to who or what did this and why. So we'll see more about that in the future books. I do have an answer. I'm just not prepared to reveal it yet.
Okay, I guess that's about as much as we're going to get out of you.
I'm trying to... Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, hey. Thank you very much.
You don't always have
you're
to.
You're welcome. It's good talk to you.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for calling, Robert.
Yep.
That's like Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama. By the end of the book, you still don't know who built the thing and who the Ramans were and all that, but it's a fascinating story that just has that lingering mystery that surrounds it.
Yeah. He's pretty certain that Clarke had an idea behind it all. He just didn't reveal it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we're going to take the next call. Hello, caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
This is Ellen Steele, and I'm calling from Denver also.
Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing you again at Mile High Con, Alistair, along with Robert. So I enjoy your books.
Thank you.
And you have some – when you do your world building, you end up with some interesting critters. You mentioned the tree squids that eat squid berries, and I know one of your worlds has skyweed. But you've had geranos and hippopotamuses and running babbits. And I was wondering, how do you come up with these critters? Because they're not far-out fantasy aliens like a lot of other people come up with. The critters that you describe are actual, they could evolve from what we know of here on Earth. And I was wondering, how do you do that?
Well, you're right. They could evolve from what we have here on Earth or what we had here on Earth 60-some million years ago. And that's a deliberate constraint on the universe. The terraformed planets have life that was imported from Earth. Therefore, I can't have animals or plants that are totally alien. And in fact, the exobiologist, George Darwin, in the first Alpha Centauri book, complains that, he's an exobiologist and these things just aren't alien enough for him. There is alien life out there. It's just not on the terraformed planets. There are planets that have not been terraformed, or at least not formed from to meet Earth specifications. They may have been formed to meet other planet specifications. To allude back to Robert's question. So what I do to come up with stuff is look at what's out there now or what was out there millions of years ago and think about, okay, if this was transported to another planet and given a few million years to evolve, what might it evolve into? And I have to say my son Robert, who is a budding paleontologist, he does degree in geology and is now doing his master's in biology. He's always had an interest in paleontology, has given me a lot of input on that. Geranos are based on an animal called if I could pronounce it without butchering it from memory, Paracetherium, which is related to the rhinoceros, but is much larger. It has a long neck like a giraffe. It does not have the horns of a rhinoceros, but it is, it's about twice as big as an elephant. And this is a real animal that existed tens or hundreds of thousands of years ago. And if it can evolve once, it can evolve twice. And so this is an animal that is on Sawyer's World. Terror birds, also in Sawyer's World, are a thing that have been on Earth in the past. Tree squids, I admit, the Pacific Northwest tree octopus is not a real thing, but it was a bit of an inspiration. Basically, I just look at, you know, what was there and what, you know, with a few changes could make it more interesting. There are some animals in the next book, in the Delta Pavonis, that are evolved from a kind of mammal that went extinct about 50 million years ago.
Now, my next question, which was, are you introducing any new animals in the Delta Pavonis?
Oh, yeah. It's based on a real animal, which I don't remember the name of off the top of my head, but it's there are a species of mammals called multituberculates, named for their unusually large teeth, and they were actually prevalent for about 100 million years. They were very successful for a while, and the biggest of these reached 100 kilograms, so the size of a small bear, maybe. And we have a run-in with one of those in Delta Pavonis.
Wow. Okay, another topic. I love your short stories, and I'm wondering if you have plans to add to your appliance series.
Okay. For readers who aren't familiar, or listeners who aren't familiar, first story I sold to Analog Magazine was called White Conversation. Just a very short piece, 1,000 words, and it involves a discussion. Well, it starts out with noticing that the light didn't go out when he closed the refrigerator. And it turns out that there's an intelligent slime mold living in the back, absorbing energy from the light, and he has a conversation with it. A second appliance story is called The Sock Problem and has to do with the old saw about socks disappearing in a dryer. The hero of the story, again, it's just 1,000 words, has to fix a malfunctioning clothes dryer, and it gets an unanticipated result when he does fix it. So those are the only two stories in my appliance series so far, but a number of people have asked, you know, when I'm going to write another one. I have been thinking about it. I have a few ideas. The problem is there aren't a lot of appliance myths I can build around. Next one might be a flying toaster, but based on the old screensaver.
Well, you can always invent your own myths, too.
Well, this is true. This is true.
That's why we're writers. We create. We create our own worlds, characters, myths.
Oh, absolutely. That's half the fun.
Yeah, I've always
thought. Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you at Mile High Con.
Thank you. Me too.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the idea of terraforming too, which is where you basically change a planet to make it Earth-like, so that it's
exactly.
Comfortable for humans to live there, or for animals and creatures from Earth to live there. Mm-hmm. You might have to add an atmosphere. You might have to bring land up out of the sea or whatever in order to do it. But whatever it takes, if you're going to start with life that's from Earth, if it came from Earth maybe 100 million years ago, then things could be evolving in parallel. Or if it's a more recent time, like, you know, 10,000 years ago, then you'd expect a lot of similarities. But there's still so much life on Earth that we haven't discovered, too. I mean, go into the deep ocean depths and look at what's living around the sea vents and living off sulfur and whatnot.
Sure.
It's just remarkable, the possibilities. So if you seeded another terraformed planet with life from Earth, say, 100 million years ago, there is no telling what could be living there now. And that's just a fascinating thought. And it's fun having that opportunity that you have, Alistair, to just let your imagination run with it.
Well, I'm certainly having fun with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of letting your imagination run, where do you come up with a lot of these ideas? Do they just come to you? Do you ponder them?
A lot of them just come to me. I mean, you know, I've been reading science fiction for probably, well, almost 60 years now, and watching it. So the stuff just, you know, comes in, filters around, swirls around, reacts with each other, and you know, pops out. I'm still interested in the stuff. I read science magazines and science articles online, and something will provoke an idea. Some ideas I can work into a story, some I can't. Some I think I can work into a story, and I get halfway through it. You know, find somebody else has either done it better or done it worse, but then, you know, I don't want to do it. After that, I don't want to do it. And I started work on a novel called Apollo 18, which I gave up on when the movie Apollo 18 came out. We had a lot of the same ideas. I did not like the way it went, but I figured, you know, people are going to read my story after the movie came out and figure, well, he just ripped off the movie. Well, I didn't, but, you know, I can write other stuff.
Right, yeah, well, these things happen.
Let's sell some of these books. You've got your Carson and Roberts T-Space series, and I'm showing 5 volumes. The Char Talisman, that's with an Indiana Jones flavor. And
yeah, the whole series, I call it Carson and Roberts. The two main characters are Hannibal Carson. He's the archaeologist. He's a very Indiana Jones-like character. And Jackie Roberts, she's a starship pilot. She owns and operates her own starship. Now, in my universe, starships are not very big. The interior volume of her ship is maybe like a mobile home or a large RV. And there are physical reasons why, based on the warp physics. But Chara Talisman, it looks like it's pronounced Chara, but it's based on a Greek word, so it's Chara. I go either way. That was based on a story that I wrote for Analog Magazine called Stone Age. The archaeologist, Carson, on the planet Vertigree at Delta Pavonis, you know, to bring it back to something we were talking about before, discovers an artifact, a talisman that is, you know, it looks like it's just a Stone Age carving. It looks like it might have a star map carved on it. That turns out to have high-tech innards. It's got electronic circuitry inside. It also turns out that the bad guys, a group called the Valkyrians, who are vaguely Nazi-like and figure, you know, terraformed planets are for humans, not for intelligent aliens. They think it might lead to a cache of alien weapons. So a secret outfit solicits Carson to go find, you know, whatever the star map is pointing to, and assign him a ship. The ship they assign him to is piloted by Jackie Roberts, who, as it happens, is Hannibal Carson's ex-girlfriend. So there's some tension there. They have some history between them. And so the first book is them going to find what this star map points to. They discover it on a planet orbiting the star Chara, which is also known as Beta Canum Venaticorum. Chara is much easier to say. They find a pyramid-like structure on the planet and explore that. When they get back, it turns out there have been more of these talismans turning up in, you know, various archaeological collections and so on. And they all have slightly different star maps on them. They come to the conclusion that, you know, from one point in space, these star maps match actual constellations. And that point in space is somewhere near the star Zeta Reticuli. Now, as it happens in real life in the early 1960s, there was a UFO incident where a couple, Betty and Barney Hill, were supposedly abducted by aliens.
I remember that story.
Yeah. And then later under hypnosis, Betty Hill recalls seeing a star map showing the aliens' home world as around the Zeta Reticuli system. So Carson and Roberts head off to Zeta Reticuli to see what's up there. And meanwhile, because all of the old UFO files are, copies of copies of copies, so they want to get a hold of the original Betty Hill star map. So they send an agent to Earth to dig through archives to find that. And, of course, the bad guys, the Velkarians, are interested too, so they're pursuing both Carson Roberts to Zeta Reticuli and our other characters to Earth, and stuff happens. Hijinks ensue. it turns out that they meet when Carson Roberts get to Zeta Reticuli, they find a ruined city. They find actually all the cities are abandoned and partially ruined. And this is all very strange. They do get met by actual aliens who, in a pyramid-shaped spaceship, who basically ask them to leave and not come back. But that's that leads to the next book, which is the Eridani Convergence. The Velkarians stop at a star called 82 Eridani on the way back to the Alpha Centauri system. Meanwhile, there's rumors of another alien artifact being found on that planet. So, again, Carson and Roberts go out to see what's up and have some more conflicts with the Velkarians and end up chasing the Velkarians back to, well, one agent chases them back to Delta Pavonis while Carson and Roberts get back to Alpha Centauri. So the story kind of splits there. Centauri Surprise is what happens at Alpha Centauri after that, mostly with Hanel Carson and the Pavonis Insurgents, which is the fifth volume, is the agent on Delta Pavonis investigating the Velkarians, and then Roberts goes out to pick him up and bring him back to Alpha Centauri. And that wraps up one overall arc between Carson and Roberts, and then the next, I don't know how many series, but...
We're getting ready to run out of time here. So I wanted to leave a little bit of a few seconds here. Where can people find you on social media?
I'm on mostly on Facebook as my name, Alistair Mayer. I have a web page on Amazon, so you can go to Amazon, look up any of my books, and it'll link to my page. And I have my own website, which has a blog, and it has a wiki for T-Space at www.alistairmayer.org. Nope, that's .org, not .com.
Okay.
Okay, now next week we've got C.S. Boyack. Week after.
Stephen, we can't hardly hear you.
Next week we have C.S. Boyack. You hearing that?
Yeah.
It's better.
And then the week after, Mark Hearn and Leah Seawright. After that, Karen Ingalls with Carol Tucker. And then the week after that, Susan Hughes with my independent editor. And we're about out of time. So I'm going to sign off. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Alistair.
Yep.
Well, thanks again. And look forward to maybe doing this again sometime.
All right.
We will see everybody again next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.